That is the straight blowing jazz of Courtney Pine, and this is the Metabulous 2 podcast, episode 111. I am David.
And I am Ben.
And welcome to our look at Silver Nemesis.
Smooth jazz. Nice.
Straight blowing.
if any of you are not fans of Jazz Club from the Fast Show, please, I implore you, go to YouTube, look up Jazz Club from the BBC comedy series The Fast Show, and that will be nice.
Right.
Right. Cool. Jazz. I love jazz. It's my favorite form of music.
Well, Courtney Pine, well, he was
He was a big deal. He was a big deal at that time.
He was new on the scene. He was one of the, I think...
like a sex machine.
Well, he was one of the first black jazz musicians in the UK to kind of break through.
I thought you were going to say he was one of the first black jazz musicians, and then I was going to disagree with you.
No, well, being the musical expert... Oh my, hang on, my tower of books just tumbled.
Uh-oh, it's a disaster. Much like Silver Nemesis. Right. I think he was, actually. Though, now we're probably going to get thousands of jazz fans writing in, like, disagreeing, you know, that blind Willie McTavish from Glasgow was the first British.
Well, he was
in 1927 or something. Anyway,
big
whatever.
Enough that the writer, young Kevin Clark, wrote him in deliberately so he could meet him.
Yes. And I think there's quite a lot of that happening in this particular story of Doctor Who.
The story itself is a bit of a mess.
Yeah. We get people writing in their favorite jazz musicians, mm-hmm. people writing in their favorite stars of American musical theater.
Dolores Gray.
Who's she? I still don't know who she is.
Was she
famous then? I don't know. She's not famous now, certainly.
No.
No. Anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. So well, it's a good story for Ace, more or less.
Yeah, Ace is brilliant in it, actually. Ace is easily the best thing in the entire story, in my humble opinion. Oh, that and the Nemesis statue, which actually looks kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Played by Fiona Walker, who was in Keys of Marineth, episode 6.
Yeah, of course she was. Exactly, yes.
Also, we have a cameo by Nicholas Courtney in here.
Yeah, why is that, honestly?
He is, well, because they had Courtney, John Nathan Turner wanted to have a whole bunch of people associated with Who, because this was the 25th anniversary special.
Who cares?
We got that. So we had, you know, a few directors, Peter Moffat, Andrew Morgan, Fiona Cumming, and then Nick Courtney in the crowd scene touring the faux Windsor Castle.
They should have had Nick Courtney and Courtney Pine together in the same scene.
The two Courtneys.
Nick Courtney Pine.
And like you said, yeah, this was the inspiration potentially for Moffat for Fezzes and Mops.
Yes.
Which McCoy wears in the vault of Windsor.
Well, yes. Not actually the vault of Windsor Castle, but anyway, yes.
Right, well, purported to be in the story. For story purposes.
Yes. For dramatic purposes, Arundel Castle does stand in for Windsor Castle, yes. Why are we in Windsor? Why is the story set in Windsor again?
I think J&T had a thing for royalty. Wasn't he trying to get one of the royal family to be in it?
Oh, yes. That's the reason it's in Windsor, because J&T thought he could get Prince Edward to be in it.
You're right. Okay.
Which didn't happen. Yes. Mm-hmm. So another instance, I'm afraid, of this of unnecessary things being shoehorned into this story for no really apparent reason.
And they had a queen impersonator there walking her corgis.
Extremely convincing queen impersonator that looked just like the queen.
I think her name is Mary Reynolds, and this is like her job.
Yeah, I'd never heard of her before, and I've never heard of her since, but apparently she's some kind of well-known queen impersonator.
It's a living.
Maybe it's a living. Yes, exactly. Gets you on Doctor Who from time to time.
So
they should hang on. Who do they get to impersonate the Queen in the Titanic falls out of the sky.
You know, I don't know this.
Yeah. They should have got her, because then she would have been the right age.
Well, she's currently still doing it.
Well, they should have got her to be the queen.
Maybe
why
they
didn't
did.
They?
I don't know. Do we have to sidebar and just double check this?
No, we don't. We're fine. Our fans will write in and tell us. But I mean, if Russell T. Davies didn't do that, he missed a trick, and I'm no longer a fan of it.
So let me see. We have Nazis.
With Anton Dufresne playing De Flores.
One of his final roles.
Sadly, one of his final roles.
And
exactly.
And he took it because they were filming this November special in June during Wimbledon, so he could watch the tennis.
Come over from Germany to watch Wimbledon. Of course, Anton Dufresne, for those of you who don't know, was also a star of one of the greatest movies ever made, which is Where Eagles Dare. Mm-hmm. He was a Nazi in that.
He's a little bit typecast. He fled. Yeah. He fled 1930s Germany for Canada and became an actor. Good. But he was always cast playing Nazis.
But once a German, always a German. You can't ever avoid just being a Nazi all the time. Yeah, I think. I mean, it's reasonably clear that he's not entirely happy playing a Nazi and then a cyberized Nazi and then back to a normal Nazi again in this episode of Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm. And the Walkmen. That's what I think what they were actually called, the guys with the tape decks or whatever, and the headphones.
So what? They're never really explained, are they?
No.
How do they know the Doctor and Ace are watching Courtney Pine in that pub, that unlikely jazz concert in a pub garden in Windsor?
Cyber planning? I don't know.
Okay, good. No, that's good. That's good. It's cyber planning. As we all know, the Cybermen have the most ridiculously convoluted
You know, there's probably pairs of Walkmen staged strategically all around Windsor at various pubs, and these were the two blokes that just happened to
strike it lucky.
Intersect.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, for all times and all times of Windsor, there were cyber Walkmen. I'm sad that RTD didn't bring back the Cyber Walkman for one of his cyber shows. Mm-hmm. The Cyber Walkman
would have been good.
Their special silvery guns. Reading the info text on the DVD as I was. Mm-hmm. Apparently, originally the plan is that Ace and the Doctor would be attacked by Cybermats, and for some reason it was decided that Cybermats would be too expensive, which has never really affected the use of Cybermats in the past.
Wasn't this a season where we had a crane shot lowering a
exactly.
a Dalek scout ship?
Exactly, and we had the Cybermen ship apparently being played by a helicopter. You can see the blades whizzing around in the background. But anyway, apparently the Cybermats were deemed to be too expensive. A bridge too far. Another war film. We got some Xboxes and sprayed them silver, and they became the Cyber Walkman.
Yeah. Well, they were probably actually vintage, authentic Sony. Well, they weren't vintage. Contemporary Sony Walkman
contemporary
of the
Sony
1989
Walkman.
Or 88.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're kind of dotting all over the place on this one.
We are because
we're not really focused.
Well, neither
very
is much the story.
Very much like the story itself.
I've watched this story far too many times for a story
really?
That I
how
just,
many times have you watched it?
I can't more than a dozen times. Not for this podcast, but over
Christ,
over
I was
my
gonna say, I've watched
over
it
my,
once for this podcast.
No, over I watched it once
over the course of your life,
over
right.
the course of my life for right. a story that I am just not enamored with. And
did you see the when it was, because there's all this guff that I haven't really actually bothered to find out about, there being sort of there was this documentary made for like the American market, and then there was like the
VHS tape,
the expanded VHS, because I never had the VHS. Ooh. did you have the VHS?
Yeah, I have
tape?
The VHS, and you can find that documentary.
Is it online? The documentary?
The documentary is on YouTube.
Oh, okay. I should look that up.
It's very 1988 U.S. PBS pledge break type fodder, but it is informative.
Right, okay.
And I suspect that they'll work really hard trying to secure the rights for the Blu-rays when that comes out for season 25.
I think they'd be, I think they'd be foolish not to.
Well, they tried for the DVD, but they weren't able to, but maybe this time around. And even the one that was on the VHS has been edited down because Eric Sayward was stingy with rights for certain bits.
All right. So, interesting. Okay.
So I doubt I have this somewhere in my archive, the actual aired version with their Eric Sayward bits in it, but the pretty much the complete version is on YouTube.
Do you think they'll do, because I mean, I watched some of the cut scenes, they're on the DVD. It's really obvious that that it's just been slashed around to try and get it to...
And reordered.
Reordered. It's just ridiculous. I mean, I'd be curious to see whether they try and do, like, you know, a recutting of it, or like a, you know, a reorganized, you know what I'm talking about, like a recut version.
For the director's edit. Well, they'd have to get Kev McCullough in there to do some extra music, because
would they?
The 30 minutes that he did for Silver Nemesis isn't enough.
Oh, that it's not enough Kev McCullough music. They should commission him to do more. or maybe they could just get Courtney Pine in to do some twiddling over the top of it. Yeah, they would. That's true. But I mean, it would be interesting to see whether it flows better. Because it's really, especially the last episode, it just drops in and out of what the hell's going on.
Yeah, the bit with the Miss Remington Dolores Gray, I think that is the point. I made a little note of it. This is just bad Doctor Who until 8 minutes 30 seconds into it with episode 3, where I just go, ugh. And that's where the limo pulls up with Miss Remington, Mrs. Remington. And it just loses me after that. I just can't deal with it.
It's such a shame that they were cutting out scenes that told the story in order to shoehorn in bits that the producer of the show wanted to have in because he wanted to meet Dolores Gray. I mean, that's kind of it's kind of as simple as that, isn't it, really? Yeah. I mean, she's not...
I don't know. Was that the reason?
Well, again, so this is really... I mean, I'm only quoting from the info text.
Thank you, Richard Molesworth.
Which is, you know, maybe Richard Molesworth's opinion, but I'm going to take it as gospel, that it was simply really that Nathan Turner, being a, you know, particular kind of gay man, was really enamored by American musical theater, especially American musical movies of the, you know, 50s and 60s, was a huge fan of Dolores Gray, knew that she was in London for the Follies, and really desperately wanted to meet her and have her in his show. And that's why there is, you know, there's 5 minutes, or felt like 5 hours. It's probably only a couple of minutes. But anyway, that's why there's this huge section of just what? We don't care how they get back to Windsor. They've been leaping around time for a start.
Right.
And, you know, it's obviously not Windsor.
Well, it's Windsor to Americans.
Windsor to Americans, exactly, you know. So, yeah, it's a shame, you know, that they cut out actual story in order to fit in kind of business.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that is a pity.
Yeah, well, the other bit that was really shoehorned in was, I think this is Cartmell, in all the chess bit. And just going back in time and all the chess bit. Well, it's foreshadowing for Curse of Fenric to kind of lay the seeds at the of this chess game. But it doesn't fit within the story. It just takes away from trying to explain what's going on. And the idea, really, of Nazis versus Cybermen with the Supermen and the Giants, that has potential.
That's nice. I like that. Yeah.
But this is like a grab bag of ideas that don't congeal or work together.
No, there's too many villains. There's too many villains for a start. I mean, there's three sets of villains, four sets of villains if you include the Walkmen, who are not really ever connected. Well, I guess
they're just bad guys. But then you have the skinheads.
And then what's the business with the skinheads? I mean, there's this kind of comedy. There's this desire for comedy throughout, which is what exactly is the point of the skinheads. It establishes that
Richard is really tough, and are they from the 16th century, 17th century, 16th century?
I think they'd be from the 16th century.
17th century.
I beg your pardon. They're from the 17th century.
Right,
yes,
that they were much more tough because of, you know, reasons. They're tougher than skinheads.
Yeah, so he somehow knocks them out in the middle of Windsor High Street, carries them what must be several miles to like a wood on the side of a hill,
right,
strips them down to their underpants, burns their clothes, ties them upside down from a tree. It's just what? You know, it's just it's too much. Too much.
Yep. It should have been a scene that was cut. It's funny, but it doesn't really fit within anything. It would have been better if these were the Cyber Walkmen or something like that.
I think let's demonstrate Richard's, you know, warrior capabilities by having him take down the Walkman. Yes, absolutely.
So, I mean, the only person that Richard kills is the old mathematician.
Yes. Yes.
So that's the other thing. Why? I guess they needed blood for this witchcraft, black magic, time travel, which is an eye roller. But
yeah, if time travel was that easy, everyone would be doing it. Right. To be honest,
right? Yeah.
I mean, I guess isn't the implication that is in well, what I'm taking away, which mm-hmm. I think is maybe what I'm supposed to, is that there's a connection between the Nemesis statue and Lady Payne 40. And that
right.
somehow helps her travel through time,
right?
Right,
right. That's the that's connected
in some way.
It's the hand wavium that's done that she has. She knows more than she's supposed to about the statue, living metal, vanadium, the doctor's history,
and it's kind of reached back through time to kind of bring her forward to something. That's what I was. That's what I was understanding. I mean, they should have just slowed down and just cut a whole bunch of stuff out of it and just, you know, I mean, again, either, I mean, made a decision, do we want, you know, kind of John Dee style 17th century magicians versus the Cybermen, or do we want the boys from Brazil, Fourth Reich style Nazis versus the Cybermen? I'm not sure it really benefits from having both versus the Cybermen.
Well, it sets up this triangle of power between Pinefort and the Cybermen and the Doctor, right?
Yeah, it's, I guess. Yeah.
You know, it's not straightforward, but it's sort of like all the subplots been removed from the story, so you just get these three factions kind of batting heads, and you get these really awkward continuity bits where DeFlores he's a Walkman and then he isn't a Walkman.
Yeah, he gets cyberized and then he gets de-cyberized, or maybe he's still cyberized.
Or maybe he just took off the headphones.
Yeah, he was listening to some like crucial Courtney Pine smooth jazz, and then, oh, I can't bear this crap. It doesn't sound like Wagner anymore.
See, Courtney Pine, I think, is one of the better things in it. And just the,
really?
The,
I hate jazz. That's why
I know
I
you
like
do.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's why I did the introduction too. So.
Of course, exactly.
But no, I like Courtney Pine. I like his jazz, and I think just the way Clark weaves that in to jamming the cyber signal was
irritating.
You
know, if you want to make, I'm sorry, I'm interrupted. Carry on.
Oh, so if you wanted to meet your jazz hero or someone you're interested in and you wanted to work it in, it was a good way of doing it. Reintroducing the boombox. The Doctor, I guess, makes Ace a boombox after losing in a remembrance of the Daleks. It works kind of as a magical Time Lord device.
Could have just gone forward and gotten her iPod, though, couldn't he, really?
He could have done that, or at least... have a tape deck with an auto reverse, which was pretty common at the time. So
That is true. Anyway.
So I guess focusing on things that we like, Ace, I think, is stellar in this. Sophie Aldred did her own stunt going off into the river, off the little bridge on their way back to the TARDIS when they're shot by the Walkman. Her own stunts up on the gantry in episode 3 where she's using a slingshot to take out Cybermen with a gold coin. Ace is given things to do. She blows up the cyber ship. The attempts at humor, though, I think fall flat, where something like Clark is trying to get Richard being terrified of llamas.
Which apparently, according to the Infocats, were supposed to be giraffes.
Giraffes? Okay.
Yeah, which is why he's like kind of terrified and like confounded by llamas, which they don't look a lot like cows or horses. But they don't look enough different from cows or horses to have the kind of reaction that he has. But he has the kind of reaction that he has, according to Richard Mulworth, because they're supposed to be giraffes from Windsor Safari Park. Which again, kind of, because
I thought
Windsor,
they were. I thought lions would have made more sense. Even
well, okay, this is more infotext. I'm guessing.
We're performing a service here.
We are. Cause you don't have to watch the infotext now. So apparently, because we had to set this show rigorously in Windsor. Because reasons, and Windsor certainly during the 70s and 80s, when I was a lad, was well known for Windsor Safari Park, which is a, you know, you have these in America. It's like it's a big open. It's instead of a zoo, all the animals just run around in a big field, and they have lions. So originally, the kind of tomb and the vault and all that kind of stuff was supposed to be in Windsor Safari Park. So Richard would be frightened by giraffes, because obviously giraffes, you know, are kind of intimidating. But the skinheads, and I've only just remembered this, the skinheads were supposed to being have been threatened by lions rather than strung upside down.
Okay.
Lions from Windsor Safari Park.
They couldn't get them? They were too expensive or too dangerous?
Well, they were, well, they were shooting the whole thing in Arundel. So
I see. Okay, yeah.
About 50 miles from Windsor.
They were in the wrong place.
They were on the place. And it's clearly not Windsor. I mean, that's the, my other kind of beef with it is that it's A, it's pretty obviously Arundel Castle. It's pretty obviously the South Downs rather than Windsor, which is quite flat. And also the, I just, again, this is part of my problem with the whole thing, is that they kind of toggle from ostensibly Windsor Castle and Windsor High Street to this kind of abandoned factory. If you know Windsor, there are no abandoned factories near Windsor. So where that was actually taking place, who knows? It's a very, very kind of, you know, quite densely populated part of the world. Mm-hmm. To have a gunfight and a meteor landing and then a spaceship landing and then a spaceship blowing up with no one turning up apart from Dolores Gray is really kind of weird, actually.
Right. Well, they had the police and then this strange, weird gas venting around the Nemesis spaceship.
Yeah, what was that?
I think that was another excuse not to use Cybermats. I don't know.
Yeah, I could. Again, I mean, it implies that the Cybermen already knew where it was going to land. Anyway, you know, whatever. Yes.
Right.
Yes, I think Cybermats would have been better all along, to be honest, and damn the expense.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things that would have been better. Just, yeah. We have talked about this story before, but like you said, removing one of the baddies from it. Either go with the Nazis or either go
just
with the Cybermen.
Streamlined it, yeah. Either go with the Nazis or go with the you know, this 17th century magician. And I actually can't decide which would be better. I mean, I do like Nazis, and as you point out, it's a controversial thing to say nowadays.
You like Nazis as a villain.
I do like Nazis as a villain. Yeah, yeah. I don't actually like Nazis. Right. I don't care for their ideology particularly. But anyway, and as you point out, you know, the kind of giants and Wagner and you know, Superman, that fits quite well.
That was even funny, though, that, you know, the DeFlores goes in, I don't know if you're familiar with Wagner's Ring das Nibelung, and then David Banks, cyber leader, goes, of course, but why should we form an alliance with you? And, I mean, that's funny, I think, that the Cybermen know about Wagner.
It is actually an hilarious line, in fact, and you just imagine them sitting in their cyber ships.
Dun, 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 dun.
excellent rendition of my favorite opera.
Wagnerian Cybermen.
Yeah, or 17th century magicians who would be cool. Who also then, you know,
well, just all the black magic and
all the black magic stuff. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know. I can't decide. I actually don't really care enough to decide between the two. But I think one of them has to go.
Well, just one of the three, right? So we have the Cybermen, three, yeah. We have the Nazis, or we have Lady Painfort.
Yeah, one of them has to go.
Yeah.
I mean, we could have just not had the Cybermen, to be honest.
Well, that's another JNT mandate, that he needed the Silver Cybermen for the Silver Anniversary.
Yeah, well, that's bollocks. So, but yes. Yeah, I mean, far be it from me to decide that we're not going to have one of Doctor Who's great monsters in a show, but I think actually it would have been better without the Cybermen. I think Nazis versus 17th century witches is
perfect.
Cool.
That's Indiana Jones right there.
It's Indiana Jones right there, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would have been super cool.
The other problem, I think, with having the Cybermen in is if both cliffhangers in part one and part two are, oh, it's the Cybermen landing, and then, oh, it's a cyber fleet in space for part two.
Oh, there's more of them, yes.
I think JNT had the success in his second series in Davison's first season with Earthshock. And that's why he hired Sayward.
Right.
And that's why we had Resurrection. And it seems like he's always trying to recapture that reveal in a bottle. But there's a difference between the Cybermen not having appeared for 7 years from Revenge to Earthshock than having the same type of cliffhanger, the same type of story every season because it was really popular once in 1982, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's the master of the 70s syndrome. It's like, well, actually, you know what? We're kind of expecting the Master now because he's always in the story. We're kind of expecting the Cybermen, A, because it's called, well, I guess it's called Silver Nemesis. It's not called the Silver Nemesis of the Cybermen, though it may as well be. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not a surprise when they turn up at all. It's right. Kind of, you know, and they're still wearing those moon boots and they've got those chest units that, like, flap around. And they're wearing those, you know, baseball mitts or whatever they do as hands.
And just
cricket.
So vulnerable to gold. You would think...
Really super vulnerable to gold,
you
yeah.
would have thought that with J&T having the Daleks float upstairs in remembrance at the beginning of this season, that, you think we can be harmed by gold? We've engineered against that or something. You would remove that silly vulnerability that was introduced in Revenge of the Cybermen.
You know what they should have done? They should have made them more vulnerable to Jazz. and what should have happened is that Courtney Pine should have like leapt out from behind like a tree or something or like a pile of rubble and then played his saxophone at them. And the Cybermen would have gone, no, oh, this is not Fognerian enough. And then died because the coolness of his jazz scrambled their cyber circuits.
Too emotional.
Too much emotion.
They were overwrought.
Too much emotion.
Yeah.
See, again, this stuff writes itself, if only if you pay attention. Just to rewind a bit. Aces, just go back to Sophie Aldred. Yeah. Aldred. Mm-hmm. Eldred.
Sophie Eldred. Eldred. Sophie Eldred.
Sophie Eldred and Ace. Mm-hmm. Her battle with the Cybermen is like genuinely exciting.
Yes.
It's really, really good. The stunts she does are excellent. Mm-hmm. And it's actually kind of thrilling.
Yes.
And she's like with her catapult and with the gold coins, like bam, bam.
Right.
It's great. It's really, mm-hmm. really good. And I really enjoyed it.
Yep. It's one of the highlights of the whole piece.
It is the highlight. Yeah. Yeah, it is one of the highlights of the whole thing. Exactly. Yeah.
One of the lowlights is trying to big up the Doctor again with, you know, he set the Silver Nemesis or the Nemesis off into space 350 years ago. And that Lady Painford knows his dark secret. And it's sort of like, if she didn't die or fuse with the statue, she's almost like River Song in some, Song in her bad phase.
Yeah, I'm surprised. Yeah, that's maybe she is. Maybe she's another incarnation of River Song.
Probably not, because she, probably doesn't not, she... Aside from Dolores Gray, there are two other really awkward scenes, and one of them is Painford throwing herself into the statue casket or into the spaceship and merging or dying or something like that. That was just awkward, and it's like they didn't know what they were going to do with this woman, do with her at the end. And so this was...
Yes. Poorly directed.
Well, just poorly written. Clark didn't know what he was going to do with her.
Right, right.
And the other really awkward bit is when the Doctor and Ace waltz into where the Cybermen and the Nazis are and the Nemesis is after Richard gives them the arrow, and the Doctor does these weird spinny moves to touch the bow to the Nemesis.
It's lame and it's weak, and I think it's badly written. I think also badly directed. I mean, I think they should have sat down and was like, is this actually going to work when we direct it? And, you know, it's not going to work. I can't, you know, we've got one camera here. How is this going to work? It is pretty poor.
So with Happiness Patrol, you asked why three episodes. In Silver Nemesis, we have three episodes. And Happiness Patrol is pretty much entirely studio-bound. I think completely studio-bound.
Yes,
and Nemesis is entirely field and location shooting.
Right.
And it's directed by the same director, Chris Clough. I'm wondering if this was Cartmel's solution to the six-parter.
No.
Holmes would have a 2 and a 4. Cartmel has 2 threes with totally different stories.
Well, could be. Isn't it also something to do with that whole asbestos thing, though, as well?
Well, that's why they filmed. Okay, so the soundstage that they were going to film on had asbestos, and asbestos had to be removed. And so, yes, everything was location. They lost rehearsal days, which obviously shows. They certainly filmed. I mean, there's a half hour of pretty finished scenes on the DVD. Mm. that they could have made it a four-parter and might have given a little more room to breathe.
Yeah, and I think you know, as you know, over and above, you know, having to get more Kef Kulak music, I think, you know, it desperately needs a reassemblage for the Blu-ray box set, and I would be surprised if they don't try and do that.
Are you volunteering?
Not really.
That's why it hasn't been done. Everyone just looks at the footage and goes, "Oh, you got it."
Do I have to? Do I have to try and make this make sense?
How much are you paying? Right.
How much are you pay? It's not enough
because JNT made the extended version. That was one of because he had. Oh, and the really sad. The sad thing about the documentary, the U.S. documentary, is they kind of close with JNT. And JNT's going, yep, I think 25 years, I've been with this, involved with this program since the 70s. I put in my time. I want to leave on a high note, 25 year, you know, the 25th anniversary special. And then the interviewer goes, so what does it mean if at the end of season 26, you're still the producer? And you kind of feel the room deflate a little bit, and JNT goes, well, I guess that means McCoy asked me to stay, and we know the story was he couldn't find work anywhere else. No one wanted him. Yes. So
no one wanted him at that point. Not even Dolores Gray wanted him.
Well, I'm sure he could still be the Panto producers, but
the Panto producers,
he wanted to stay in television, and you know, a lot of these. Yeah, Kevin Clark went on to be one of the writers for The Bill, but a lot of these writers that Cartmell brought on didn't have much of a writing career beyond Doctor Who.
I mean, at this point, I mean, Doctor Who kind of was a graveyard, really. Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't really go there to advance your career particularly. Though I think, I mean, Ben Aronovich has had a reasonably good career, I think.
As a writer, not in television.
As a writer, yes.
In television, yes.
Yeah, you know, I think it kind of was a graveyard of some kind. Though again, I mean, Sylvester McCoy's done all right for himself. I'm not sure Sophie Eldred's really done a huge amount more.
Well, wasn't she a children's television presenter for a while?
Oh yeah, she was. Though I guess I would have been too old to kind of really appreciate.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think she did okay.
She took the Katie Manning route, which I think is a good one.
Right, and McCoy was certainly in it too. So.
Yeah, McCoy.
I mean, McCoy's been in movies and stuff, so he's.
Oh yeah, no, he's had a great career.
I was just looking over, you know, some of the crew certainly went on. They didn't have issues. Their careers certainly weren't hurt by being in Doctor Who. A lot of them are still working in BBC, and they're still producing shows. They've moved up, and they're, you know, line producers and producers and bits. Yeah. So. I think it might have been a graveyard mostly for the top of the hill and some of the writing talent.
Yeah. What do you think? So one thing that was kind of striking me is just how archaic the effects seem. You know, the title sequence always just kind of grates on me, this era of Doctor Who. And I think it even did at the time, actually. Part of it is the music, which I don't really find hugely successful. But, you know, the scene of the cyber spaceships, you know, there's millions of them. They were hiding, apparently. What is that lizard that the doctor sees? What is that lizard?
What kind of lizard is it?
There's a lizard that comes out. And, like, that's not a lizard that it lives in the UK. No, that
you
is
think,
some
okay,
lizard.
That's not one of those viperapparous lizards or whatever, viperapparous.
It's not. It's a lizard they got from some pet shop somewhere. That is not a natural lizard.
Okay.
But why couldn't they use, like, a mouse? Why does it have to be a lizard?
I
was vaguely thinking like there was like a chameleon or something, which would be an even more kind of, you know, anyway.
They must have a chameleon circuit.
There you go. Yeah, so it seems super dated in a way that 70s Doctor Who doesn't seem super dated, and I'm trying to work out why. And the only thing I thought, what seems dated about 70s Doctor Who, which of course is, you know, this Doctor Who I like the best, well, apart from the 60s, which I also like. One of the things that kind of dates 70s Doctor Who a lot is the CSO, which, you know, really kind of like, what the hell's going on there?
Right.
And it seems to me that one of the kind of challenges of Doctor Who is it's always been a kind of an experimental. It's always been a show that the BBC has sort of experimented with, especially with kind of new technology.
Right.
And it certainly was, you know, experimenting in the 70s with CSO as a new technology. And it seems to be, again, you know, the kind of electronic music and you know some of the it's the computerized effects, I think, that look so poor in 80s Doctor Who. And it's, again, I think it's because of the it's always been this experimental show, which I think it's good in some ways. It's good, but it also makes it look super dated super quick.
I think the problem with in doing anything CGI, anything computer graphics, is that technology advances and changes so rapidly that things look dated. And even if you look at like series 3 of Doctor Who, especially like the Lazarus experiment with Tennant,
that's true.
That looks horribly bad now. I think it looks really dated. It looked pretty, it didn't look very good at the time it was broadcast, but it has not aged well. So more reliance on computerized effects, I think, make it more dated. And in the 70s they were more practical effects with stop motion or models, and I think that holds up better because filming a model is more realistic than computer generation.
Also, I mean, I think the other thing to point out is that Britain was absolutely the center of the world in terms of kind of model effects. You know, what with Super Marionation and Gerry Anderson and you know, Pinewood, all those great effects driven movies were all model driven movies. I mean, the kind of talent, and I'm not saying all that talent was working in Doctor Who, but that talent was all certainly was all mentoring people who were working in Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. So
I don't know. I mean, the normal things that date it would be, you know, clothing, hairstyles. I don't know how this could have been salvaged other than Cartmill and J&T seeing through Clark's smokescreen at the beginning, where he didn't have an idea beyond Doctor Who. And the answer to that question is he's God.
Yeah, I mean, that Doctor Who moment at the end is actually kind of cool, to be honest.
That's okay, but that's his pitch. He went in without a story, and he spitballed it and came up with Doctor Who is God. And then J&T said, well, we need Cybermen for Silver, and Cartmill had his own agenda with the chess, I think. It's too much of a mess, and the way you salvage this is you get rid of at least one of the baddies, one of the villains. You either get rid of the Nazis, Lady Painfort, or
Cybermen.
Yeah,
and I think we're agreed. I think the ones to get rid of are the Cybermen.
Yeah, I think so.
I think this would have been really pretty awesome if, well, it had a better chance to be awesome if it didn't have the Cybermen. The Cybermen feel
too big. It tries to big it up. A little
bit. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, And you could have had the statue, and, you know, it could have all been done. The Nazis hunting, you know, Nazis, the cult, they love the cult, all that kind of stuff. They were searching for this statue, and there was black magic from, you know, the 16th century. It's all, it works brilliantly. Brilliantly.
And if you needed Cyberman, you could have done a two-part Cyberman story, or just a one-off Cyberman story.
One-off Cyberman story, yeah.
A one-part Cyberman story that, what if you did this? What if you had the introduction to be Cybermen, and you had Cybermen defeated by Lady Painfort back in time?
What? Oh, are you kind of...
So you have your first part of that, and then you don't have Cybermen muddling through the entire story. And then part four, instead of Dolores Gray, you have Cybermen return through time or something to reap the revenge on Lady Painfort, and they find that the Nazis battling Painfort for the statue, and then you have that whole Wagnerian bit with the Supermen, and it's like Klieg and Tomb of the Cybermen, though, with the logicians, that type of thing.
Or here's my idea. How about instead of the Silver Nemesis statue being like a separate thing made of like special magic metal of some kind, it's a Cyberman.
Ooh.
And so the Nazis are trying to find like a long lost Cyberman, and Lady Painfort is trying to find a long lost Cyberman, and I don't know how it got there, but you know, and they all want it because it knows they can make them immortal or something, because you know Cybermen can
cyber
make
technology
you immortal
by
cyberizing you. I don't know. So
maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Whatever. the point is what they have here doesn't work. It's just too much. There's too many toys in the toy box to have a cohesive story.
Notes. Yep. Too many notes.
Mm-hmm.
What else would I have to say about it? Oh, here's something for, like, you know, design nerds. Why do the Nazis have Israeli machine guns?
I don't know.
I would have thought that was the last sidearm, automatic sidearm that the Nazis would buy, like Jewish ones.
Mm.
They should have had German ones.
That's it.
That was like, that doesn't work well.
Yeah.
There's some other little niggles that I had.
Them dropping Richard back off in time.
That could have been done better, I think. Mm-hmm. What would have been awesome if, like, suddenly the bird on the lute had just, like, started doing jazz. Jazz lute. Well, however that would sound, that would have been really kind of amazing.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, the whole Richard character was weird. He only really seemed to be there so Lady Penny 40 would have someone to talk to, mm-hmm. which I guess makes sense. And I guess she's his companion, like the doctor has a companion.
I have a note here saying, was Richard the companion that never was? Was he being billed up as a potential companion for the doctor to travel with Ace?
That's an excellent note. Yes. He'd have been a brilliant companion with his little beard and his, you know, amazing, his being scared of llamas.
He seemed a little Jamie to me.
Oh, very Jamie, yeah. And he could have been a love interest for Ace.
Well, yeah.
not that we needed that, but that was a joke. I think he would have been a good extra companion because he's got skills. He can fire a bow and arrow.
Can kill old men.
He can kill old men. He's a very bad hitchhiker.
Mm-hmm. Oh, jeez. Yeah. Well, that was deliberately bad.
Really? Yes. Again, some kind of funny, some business there that really didn't need to be present in some ways. Well, there you go. Yeah. Silver Nemesis.
Yeah. Okay.
It's not very good, everybody. It's not very good. When we get that season on Blu-ray, let's see what the reassembled, fully cut version looks like.
If they do it. They might just have the same reaction that you did.
And just say, nope, we're not doing this. But of course, I mean, you know, those Blu-ray sets, they're going to do them by season. By the time they get to McCoy, they're going to be pretty slimline, since there's only four stories of three episodes each.
So they got to bulk them up somewhat.
Got to bulk them up somewhat. So, you know, awkward PBS documentary, secure those rights.
Mm-hmm.
Director's cut for, you know, everything from Ghostlight to Fenric. To, right. Yeah, the whole lot gets a director's cut.
Right. Well,
yeah, okay, I'm done.
Yep.
Yeah.
For rewatch tips, I suggest watching at 25% speed faster. It makes it go by a little bit more tidy.
Yeah. Or, I mean, watch it with the infotext. The infotext, as usual, Richard Molesworth's infotext are excellent.
Do we know if it's a Molesworth or is it Pixley? Or we don't know it is Molesworth.
We don't know. The credits at the end thank Pixley and Molesworth, et cetera, et cetera. But I always imagine it's Molesworth who's basically writing those things.
Right. Okay.
Cool.
All right. Thank you for listening to episode 111 of the Metabulous 2 podcast. I have been talking with Ben.
And I've been talking with David.
And excellent.
Excellent jazz music.
Well, we'll take us out in Courtney Pine, too.
Courtney Pine, yes. Wonderful. Good stuff. Nice.